Today on our show,
we're counting down the top 10 final shots in film.
Thanks to Kev and Trish Lawler. Thanks, kids. Hit it, Polly.
Wow.
Welcome to episode 375 of the Countdown Podcast. My name is Wayne.
And my name is Paul. Welcome to the podcast. We count down movies and sometimes television in order of awesomeness so you don't have to. And today, as we have just iterated,
the final shot, the closing shot in film.
Yeah, that last single shot which leaves you on a high in these particular cases where you're just like, damn.
Or sometimes a low.
Well, yeah, but a high as in like that was great filmmaking.
Yes, excellent. Yes,
because we are celebrating the good ones today with thanks to top level patrons of the show, Kevin and Trisha Lawler. Thank you so much for your monthly support of the show. If you want to look at the options to do so, you can hit up the link in the show notes to our Patreon page and see the various levels that are there. This is the very top one. Choose a topic every 6 months or so, also for us to do on the show. It's pretty straightforward, right? That topic.
Let's do it.
Not much more there to do, so let's get into the segment which kicks off every episode proper. It's called The Recount.
Who wants a recount?
Who
wants a recount?
Who
wants a recount?
Who
wants a recount?
Recount the week for us, Polly.
Yes, that's right. All the feedback this week about last week's show, episode 374, the top 10 Criterion Collection. That one was thanks to Itchon, who, as a top level patron of the show, also chose the topic.
Sup?
Asked for 100 votes, didn't get there. Thought it might be fun, but you won very easily, Wayne. 63% of the votes, representing 40 votes to you. And I got a whole 23 votes with 37%, therefore, of the vote. That's 63 overall. Not quite as many as last week, but that's all right. We'll take that. Troy Spinner, who puts all the hard work in every week and then
my man
up there, said, hardballed, almost stole it for Paul, but Police Story, Chasing Amy, and a higher Robocop sealed it for Wayne.
Whee.
Also, when can we expect the Criterion release of Reap?
I saw that. I didn't see that.
Jesse Dixon said, Paul had the better Wes Anderson film, which would have been my number one had I realized it was in the collection. Good call, man. Stephen Croon said, Chasing Amy and the Game won my vote for Wayne.
Boom. Nice.
Smiley,
very kind.
Friend of the show said, Wayne was doing great until the Game as number one. Whoo, boy. Point for Paul.
There you are.
So, look, obviously, most people... It's actually interesting that most of the... seem to be very split in the comments. Although, Robert Stewart from the Stew World Order podcast said, one has Princess Bride, the other has Pan's Labyrinth. It's like they wanted me not to vote this week.
Meaning he hates both films?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying? Okay.
Very, very rough there.
Wow!
Yep. And the man himself who gave us the topic, he said, a real tough one this week, going with Paul for Videodrome.
Videodrome.
But a very easy win to you, sir. Well played and well done. We'll see who triumphs this week this particular topic. That's it. Not much more to do, except I think, Wayne, we do need to acknowledge one other major player in the room.
My balls?
Ironically, there are two other major players. Which one? Yes, your balls. Tell us about your balls, Wayne.
Well, there was a time, ladies and gentlemen, where my balls, it looked like a grass field, except not green. And I have since started employing, thank you very much, the use of the Manscaped Lawnmower 4.0, which is a wonderful ball-shaving device, or shall I say ball-clipping device, because you don't really shave them.
No, okay? That's right.
It's got combs and stuff. Though it does have ceramic blades, which anti-nick technology on your balls, very safe, very cool. Yeah. I've not drawn any blood, although it is a close shave.
Use USB charging, you can use it, it's water resistant, so you can use it in the shower for maximum cleanliness, which is, it's nice. We don't have to be picking all those hairs off the floor, particularly let things get a little bit wild down there.
That's right.
Amazon style.
And then you roll the dice with whether you let it go down the drain or not. It's like, I'm sure it'll be fine, you know?
Depending on how often you manscape, you might wish to have a plunger in close
proximity. Every week, sunshine. My balls get attention every week. And
for what I've heard, more often than that.
I knew it as soon as I said it. And ladies and gentlemen, if you would like balls like mine, or you have a man who would like to have balls the way I described mine.
Yes.
Maybe the way to get that, in fact, definitely the way to get that is to go to manscaped.com, purchase whatever performance package, maybe some boxer shorts, which is something they're doing now.
The Lawnmower 4.0, also the brand new boxer shorts with jewel pouch.
Jewel pouch, a pouch around your sack, a pouch around your pouch, if you will. And
stops all that unpleasant sort of chafing
exactly.
And ball slapping on the inside of your thighs. Ladies, you just won't understand this. You'll just have to accept our word that this is inconvenient.
Yes,
particularly in hot
exactly.
times.
Balls, they hang, not like your clam, which is right up there. This is fine, right?
Hot damn!
I'm saying they're different problems, Paul. Different problems. So the way to get that is to go purchase
peak
any of those items.
Advertising.
go at checkout, type in the code CDPC20. That is CDPC20 to get 20% off with free shipping.
With free shipping.
Imagine. Balls,
when you're here where we are, that's a lot of money you're
saving.
No shit,
man. Normally that shit costs like a boatload, but this time.
I've been sending out some stuff for Live Stream The Cure, which we did last weekend. Mm. You know, and like, you know, you buy your t-shirts and your mugs and whatever. They're all reasonably priced. Then you send it to Australia and it's like double the price.
I know.
What in the hell?
That's the life in Australia, man.
Manscaped, absolutely kicking goals with what they're offering here.
Nice through for sure.
With us, with the paid partnership that we have with them. Thank you so much to the boffins at Manscaped, and thanks to everyone. There's been a bunch of other people who've gotten on the chat in recent times that they've also purchased, so thank you all for supporting the show in that particular way.
Give it a try, folks.
All right then, without any further ado, let's get into it on the other side of this music cue with the top 10 final shots in film.
Final shots in film, yo.
Is the topic of this week's countdown, as we have related. Now, the only criteria, which I tried to stick to, though I will admit my number 10 blends this just a little bit, is it was the final shot. Not the final scene.
No,
that will have context, and that will obviously be an important part when we do describe what's happening here, which will be a very heavily spoiled episode. So anything we mention, we're going to spoil the shit out of.
Well, at least tell you the final scene.
There's no way around it, really. So,
but they're all pretty old.
Yeah, I've got nothing on my list that's in the last 5 years from memory, so we're pretty safe in that regard. But yeah, so to be clear here,
the ending of the film, the final shot.
If you had the final scene, if you had 15 shots in that scene,
for example,
jettison that.
Exactly, like we talked about The Usual Suspects is probably one of the best endings in film history, but the final shot itself is not necessarily...
Well, it's literally the bad guy going...
Yeah.
Well, I'm gone. It's gone.
Oh, he's gone.
Yep.
Yeah, that's it. Which is cool, don't get me wrong, but does it hit a list? Not sure. Right?
Not good enough.
Neither of ours. Yeah, it didn't get
what's
us
on my list. Exactly. Put it that way. As I said, the only one I a little bit played jazz with was one where there's the final shot melds into itself a couple of times as we zoom in closer.
Yeah, that's fine.
All right, well, on that note then, perhaps I should lead away and express what that particular one is. My number 10 is from The Shining, Stanley Kubrick's well-lauded masterpiece, which I don't love the film as much as some do, maybe because I'm a bit more attached to the book.
Really?
Read that first.
Yeah, so I remember when you made me watch this film for this show, and it was... I'm glad I've seen it, and I know the shot you're talking about. Please continue.
Yeah, so basically, again, spoilers for a film that's over 40 years old and a book that's even older, but Jack Torrance meets his demise when he gets frozen to death out in the garden hedge maze, and we snap cut from that to a very long, slow dolly in towards the wall, one of the Overlook Hotel walls, which has lots of photos from the past.
Framed photos.
And we get right up on one from 1921 in July. It's about 45 seconds zoom up to it with the old-timey 1921 music playing over the top.
Yeah.
And we see, first of all, and the shot sort of stops on a wide shot of this whole...
Bunch of people
looking up at someone who's high up above them in a camera.
Yep.
In the foreground, you can see. You don't need this.
They're all dressed up 40s people and stuff. They're at a ball
or something. They're all in their tuxedos and their gowns and whatever else. And there, right in the middle, is Jack Torrance... from 1921, July 4th party, 1921. And then we kind of, like I said, it melds into the same shot, but zooming in even closer and melds in one more time right on his face.
Yeah, that's fine.
Which is echoing back to, of course, when the ghost of Delbert Grady says to him,
"You've always been the caretaker."
You've always been the caretaker, which is a really haunting moment. Like, my question is, was he there in that photo the whole time? And this is what the film leaves me with.
Well, yeah, he was.
Right? So we just didn't see it and the film was shooting the show.
That's what happened.
Or...
did he appear in the photo after having died in real life?
Does that photo change after dying and becoming, obviously,
after you made me see this, I went and did research and shit as well, like I'm sure all of you have. And Stanley Kubrick said his idea was that Jack Torrance continues to be reincarnated over time.
Ah.
Hence, you've always been the caretaker.
Therefore, he would have been in the photo the whole time.
Right. Now, let me ask you this. Is that in the book?
No.
Ah.
Not from my memory.
That's quite a departure, Paul.
Yeah, the book's quite different, and those Stephen King fans will know. Jack still dies in the film, mm-hmm. and Danny and his mum get out, but in the movie they kill Scatman Crothers.
Okay.
And in the book his character survives. So.
Oh, I'd rather he did survive. Yeah, okay.
He's instrumental in helping them through that time, yeah. That's the biggest change that the book makes, and then his character in the book, Dr. Sleep.
I was going to say, Dr. Sleep, what did you think about Dr. Sleep?
Dr. Sleep's a good film. In fact, I like Dr. Sleep more than The Shining.
The movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah,
I do because it's more relevant because it's set.
And it's got Beck Ferguson in it.
Beck Ferguson. For you. Yep. Still fucking scary. And she's so evil. God. All right. Well, anyway.
You can hear Wayne's pants straining.
No, not with
even as he talks about the evil.
I ain't down with evil women, man. You know they fuck you up, right?
All right, over to you, Wayne. What's your number 2?
Excellent. Everyone, this is a 1996 film. It's called Big Night. And
oh, okay.
I can tell you this, right? I have no idea why or how.
Wayne's had a few of those.
Yeah. Haven't we all? sure. I have no idea why or how I saw this film back in the 90s, all right? But I did see it, and I don't know why. I must have been trying to impress a woman. I don't know, right? Because it's like, it's about two.
Sounds checked out.
It's about two Italian brothers, played by Stanley Tucci and Monk, Tony Shalhoub, right?
Oh, yeah, yep.
And they're like, one is a chef, one's a businessman, and they have to do basically whatever it takes to impress a famous. They run this restaurant, and they're trying to impress this famous Italian American singer to save their failing restaurant. It's just a drama, right? It's got Minnie Driver and Isabella Rossellini in it as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is a nice, normal film, and it is it's a very celebrated film for some reason. Like the Mavens like this kind of thing. They tend to be, it's like a classic and stuff, right?
Sorry, Mavens?
Mavens, yes.
I know you've used this term before, but now I need refreshing.
Shall we say the artistic pundits.
Okay.
Culture Mavens, sometimes is the term.
All right.
So it is shot like a normal film, and it is somehow good. It has interesting dialogue, good scenes, this, that. But at the end of the film, the protagonists have lost all their money and they don't really know what they're doing next. And the final shot of the film is this single 5-minute continuous shot of,
ooh,
it's just a kitchen, right? The camera is locked in the top right hand of the room.
Oh, I'm less excited now than
I was. No, but it's just, but this is weird because at the end of the film, this hangs there for 5 whole minutes. It's Stanley Tucci walking around a kitchen with another guy. He's cooking an omelet. It's just the entire thing from cracking eggs, doing this thing, flipping it, putting some cheese in. And it's just that for 5 minutes. And you're watching it. I'm watching it sitting there going, what the fuck's going on here? There's no cuts, right? And this is the mid-90s. I don't know what the fuck cinema really is. I don't have an opinions the same I do now. What's the point of it, right? For that whole thing, it's just him sitting down and his brother comes in, blah, 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 and that's what happens. And what it seemingly says is, I don't know what it's trying to do, Paul, but what it does is, I think the tone of the scene is, by the end of it, they split this omelet and they start eating it, and the two brothers put their hands on each other's shoulders and they're like, it's okay, you know? But the way that he's shot it is, this just hangs, the whole movie's not alluding to the fact there's going to be this long shot. So I'm there going, what the fuck's this? I walk out. Then I can't stop thinking about this shot for about 3 weeks for some reason. I obviously had very little to do. Right? And I see then last year in Billions, they have a homage to this shot. There's a shot where Paul Giamatti just does this. So I think it's like this really big thing. I go researching it. Heaps of people feel that way about this shot, like me, of the original The Big Night, where it's like, what the fuck were they doing there? And for some reason it sticks in your head and it's oddly intense. It's oddly, weirdly intense. I know.
Will the omelet be runny? Or it's consistent enough.
Because you're sitting there as a viewer and you're going, what the fuck is going to happen now? And nothing is the answer. Ugh. Nothing really happens.
Sounds like that would have annoyed the
shit out
of me.
But it's bugged me for years and I've decided it's one of my favorite ending scenes because it made me think so much.
Okay.
So, you know, there you go.
Can't argue with that. My number 9 is the least known film, I think, on my list. It's from 1985. It's a New Zealand film written and or co-written and directed by Jeff Murphy. It's called The Quiet Earth. Ever
What's
heard
that?
Of this one?
I think it rings a bell, but I've definitely never seen it.
So the main character is played by Bruno Lawrence, who you might recognize. Anyway, mm-hmm. He is a sort of whatever. He works for a company that's working on, like, you know, particle acceleration and experimental shit, that kind of stuff.
Got it.
And anyway, he wakes up and the whole film is about him having woken up and he's the only person seemingly left alive.
Ah.
Because something's happened and whatever. It turns out that he knew that what they were doing was really dangerous and could do some really bad shit to reality. And it's basically winked out the entire universe. But he, as it turns out, was committing suicide at the time that this happened. And somehow that saved him. And he eventually finds two other people who are also committing suicide. And they create this sort of love triangle. Anyway,
really?
They know this event's going to happen again based on their experiment. So he decides, I'm going to volunteer to blow up this lab to ensure it doesn't happen again and save the other two.
And will he kill himself?
Yeah, seemingly it blows up and whatever else. Instead of dying, he wakes up on this beach, and the beach is otherworldly. So has he been transported? Seemingly he's died, been transported to the next life or purgatory or whatever it is. And there's these sort of weirdly shaped clouds and a planet with a sort of Jupiter style rings around it
in the sky,
is rising up through the sky. Wow. He's in silhouette as he kind of staggers towards the water.
That sounds cool.
Yeah, it's just this beautiful, haunting shot where he's moved on to the next plane of existence or the next world or whatever it is, and who knows what's next. And that's the end of the quiet Earth.
Do we know where he is?
We don't know.
We don't know. So he is either in the afterlife or in another planet for some reason.
Yep. He's not on Earth anymore, that's quite clearly. Cool. Unless Earth has changed as a result of him.
Yeah, all the Earth has changed.
Yeah. So there's all those things. I did read.
That's cool.
Someone asked the director or the cinematographer, I can't remember what the ending meant, and he said, it's clearly meant to imply he's dead. So, yeah.
But does it? Mm. Yeah. Okay. Very cool. That's nice. That's
so another one that makes you think. It's called The Quiet Earth.
The Quiet Earth. What is it, old or what?
85.
Okay.
Yeah, so cool. Yeah, quite old.
Nice one. All right. So my number 9 is, well, it's Good Will Hunting for a complete change of pace.
Ooh.
Now, at the end of Good Will Hunting.
He's driving off.
Now, right before that scene, Robin, he talks, he sends a note to Robin Williams saying, I had to see about a girl. And he's like, son of a bitch, stole my line. And then it just cuts to a shot of his car, which his friends gave him, right? Driving into this horizon. And the reason, there's another reason that I like this shot, but I actually do like it very much. I love Afternoon Delight, the song by Starland Vocal Band. Sky rockets in flight, ding, ding. All right, so I liked it way before it was popular in fucking Anchorman and all that shit, okay? I liked it when I was a kid. And if you ever watch the music video, it's
Wayne's
not very
always
good.
Liked an Afternoon Delight. Ever since he grew old enough to realize what that was.
Yeah, I don't get a lot of it, though. For some reason, the time I saw Good Will Hunting, because I didn't know who Matt Damon, no one knew who Matt Damon was, and I was just like, okay,
this film was the one that put him on the map.
That's right. And so that shot seemed, because what he was, is he was driving away from all of this shit that he was dealing with, because he just got a job with the fucking CIA, NSA or some shit, and then he's like, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to go see about this woman, and even though it's a mini driver, he still risked everything for her. So...
And that's where the film falls down for me.
That's the only real problem. But other than that, it felt like pure freedom because he just jumped out of everything and said, and he didn't even know if she would accept him when he came back because he broke up with her last time he saw each other. So this is proper, the best way to end that film. It was like hope, but not really, but hope. But he still made his own choices even though everyone wanted him to be a genius. That's what I loved about it.
Okay, fair enough. It's all that on a few lists, so fair enough choice.
Cool.
My number 8 is, with credit to listen to the show, John Huslander, who drew my attention back to this one, and I watched it again this morning, and I'm like, oh, that's a really great shot. I remember how the film ends, but not the way it's shot, and that's obviously where we're sort of coming from in this particular episode. It's from Evil Dead 2.
I'm trying to remember now. Go on. Yeah,
so in Evil Dead 2, again, spoilers for this 1987 film, Ash has gone through the portal with the great evil, and he's back in the Middle Ages, and the knights are all running around, and they're all seemingly about to slay the beast. And then there's this screech.
Oh, of course!
The thing is like this sort of pterodactyl skeleton monster is flying towards him, and he stands up and, with all the cool music, and the hero shot pulls the shotgun off and blows its head off. And all the knights then fall to their knees in front of him. As he realizes, and we realize, he is the hero who came from beyond to go in the Necronomicon.
Because he went back in time,
and he made the comment, didn't do a very good job of destroying the evil, did he? He is that guy.
Yes, I remember
and
now.
And so the shot is, it pulls back. It's on his face. He starts going, no, no. Yeah. And it pulls, racks back, this great big sort of dolly and zoom back through the crowd of knights. All four of their knees as the camera passes them. And they're all going, hail, hail.
That's right.
Hail. And then we get to the very back of them. And then two fists come up in front, blocking the view. Hail, boom, smash cut to credits.
That's cool.
It's awesome.
Man, I remember when, because Paul showed me Evil Dead when we were kids.
Evil Dead 2.
Evil Dead 2.
I don't think I would have tried to make you watch the first one.
No, it's Evil Dead 2. So that's the one you're talking about, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And at the end there, where it's like, because he goes, no, and you see that, oh my God, he's been transported back in time. He's lost everything, right? I remember turning to Paul and going, so what happens now? He goes, that's it. He's back in time. That's it. He's fucked. I'm like,
Army of Darkness.
Until Army of Darkness. And then when Army of Darkness comes out, you're like, oh, here's how he can, this is my boomstick and I can get bitches. And I was like, oh, he can still live in this part of the, it's cool. So.
First you want to kill me, now you want to kiss me. Blow.
No, the best line from that movie is that, hey, she bitch. Let's go.
Let's go, yeah.
But that was not, for that for some reason that worked for me. So nice one. Okay.
I think Evil Dead 2 is my number 8.
Very popular choice, I think. Now, my number 8 is actually the film from the film Gladiator.
Ooh.
Now, what happens at the end of Gladiator is, okay, again, spoilers, Maximus buys the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And
but only after he takes out the Commodore.
Only takes out the Commodore. Everything's all good, right? And then his friend Juba.
As opposed to the Ford.
Okay, everyone, that's fine. Paul just made a joke, everyone. Like the room to acknowledge.
Kingswood, you're not taking the Kingswood.
Will anyone get that?
I don't know.
Okay.
Some deep cuts, man.
Deep cuts. Okay.
2.5 beers in, that's where we're at.
Well, in this scene, Jaimon Honshu, who is Russell Crowe's friend, Damax's friend, returns to the Roman Colosseum to bury like effigies of Maximus's wife and son on the spot where they died and stuff like that. And then Juba promises, like, to his head, he says, you know, to his friend, I will see you again, but not yet. Which is what I say to the lanolin in my bedroom every day. But then, right?
Okay.
Then the camera pans up, right? And what happens is it's this shot of, like, this beautiful, like, fucking sky. Like, this sort of almost, like impressionistic, beautiful sky. And what it is that's this type of beauty. It's the ethereal, and it's, like, nothing you've seen in the rest of the movie. Because the rest of the movie, it's almost like...
It's dour.
This is the beauty that you've been denied all the film. And now that Russell Crowe is dead, the way it felt to me was that this is his Valhalla, or whatever they call it. They're Valhalla.
It's Vikings.
Viking, what do the Romans call it? They had the green Elysian fields or some shit like that, right? This is his afterlife because he already said, well, I'll see you again.
His hand, the shots of the hand.
That. Yeah. But even though they don't recreate that shot, because the sky looks like this now, that's where Maximus is, and that's where Jaimon Honshu will see him again someday.
Yep.
Which was just the best way to end that because fuck me, it was sad. So everyone fucking died. So there you are. Yeah, Gladiator. Always.
This is why. Oh, yeah, of course they die at the start. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Cool. My number 7 then is from the film which is number 1 on the IMDb top 250, the highest ranked film of all time amongst all movie watchers, The Shawshank Redemption from Frank
the Shank.
Darabont. Yeah, this is the end of the film is basically, again, spoilers for this 1994 film. So Red, who is narrating the story, played by Morgan Freeman, he violates his parole by heading off to where he knows that... Andy Dufresne is going to be, having escaped from the prison in the very exciting and very satisfying way that he eventually does. And I can't even name the beach of where he is, but you know, somewhere.
No, it's some cool ass beach.
Yeah, somewhere down in South America. And they basically are reunited and Andy's working on this boat scraping the hull and Red smiles at him. And then we get this great helicopter shot because drone shots weren't a thing back
then.
Right. As it's pulling away on this beach, as they rush towards each other
and
embrace.
Hug. Yeah.
It's such a uplifting moment to such a dour, dark film.
It's the broiest of bro, like, fucking action. Like, you know, this is the bomb. I often wanted to myself, because I remember when I saw this, I saw The Shawshank Redemption late, like a lot of people said. Everyone said, you gotta go see it. And I was like, I didn't know what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
End of that film, you think to yourself, like, okay, so Tim Robbins is there, he's doing it on his boat, he's free, Morgan Freeman's here, he's violating parole, but hopefully the police aren't too good in 1940, whatever.
Yep.
And what happens then? Like, what happens then?
Who I was cares?
There, well, I know who
they're
cares.
They're out, they're safe, they've got the money.
I'd love to see, like, a...
They've got a life.
Well, I would sit there and go, you know, because Tim was like, I've been working on this boat, I'm free now. I know I lost all my family and I can't see anyone ever again, but... I'm
I've got
here.
Red.
Exactly. Well, I'm here now. I'm working on a boat on a beach instead of being raped in the prison. And then Red turns up. It's like, what are we going to do now? Oh, no. How about brunch? That's what I would do.
Yep. You would do brunch.
I really would do
100%
brunch.
100% sure. And I think what really works about this shot is it's in such stark contrast to what we've seen through the whole film. This claustrophobic,
nighttime,
dank,
wet,
dark, miserable rainy. Existence. And here is, you know, the quintessential perfect beach, the beautiful blue of the water, the beautiful contrast of the sand, and here are these two right there in the widest, openest shot of the entire film. And that's what it's really trying to symbolize here. Yeah. This is freedom. So, yeah.
Frank Darabont is this shit, isn't he?
Well, he was. He absolutely was. Unfortunately, it seems like maybe the Walking... Well, he looks made too much money. But The Walking Dead really sullied him on doing shit because he hasn't had his name attached to much in recent years.
That is what he did. That's the last thing he did?
I'm not 100% sure. I'm not going to go looking up his IMDb-iography now, but that's the last thing I remember him
having. Yeah, no, I haven't heard from him in a while, for sure. Wow, very cool. Okay. Well, my number 7 is the film Heat, the last film.
Yeah,
the last
my honorable mention.
God, that's cool.
I almost put it on, but I got shopped off at the end for Evil Dead 2.
Well, you know, I was wondering how this movie would end, everyone. It's about, it's basically this top, like, super cop Al Pacino against Robert De Niro, who's a Hammer Time, like, you know, fucking robber who pulls jobs and has crews and shit like that. And they find out through the film that these cat and mouse guys going against each other, they're both two sides of the same coin. They're both very much the same man, but one is on the side of the law, the other one is... But they both have the same convictions. They both have the same, like, single-minded purpose kind of thing. They will both give up anything
for... They're two sides of the same coin, right? They are driven by one's on the right side of the law, one's on the wrong side, and there's not enough room in LA for the both of them.
That's right. And I'm sitting there thinking, how's it going to end? Because I don't want either of them to die. And the cool bit that I saw, well, right before the end, is obviously they're in a field or whatever, and it's an airport and shit, and they don't know where each other is. They're trying to, you know, shoot at each other. And then Robert De Niro decides to pop out the last moment and shoot Al Pacino, which is a silly move. He could have just fired from cover, but never mind, right? And that's exactly when the big airport light comes on. Al Pacino sees the silhouette, turns around, boom, pops him. And the last scene then is them sort of like Al Pacino standing over a fallen sort of Robert De Niro. And he actually grabs his hand. Mm-hmm. And they have this sort of like guy
handshake. He puts his hand up.
He puts his hand up and it's like, I'm sorry I shot you. I know you're like me, but this is how it had to go. And it could have easily
given
been
you a little bit of comfort in his final moments.
Right. And then the airline, boom, cut to black. I'm like, fuck, that's cool. And he doesn't quite die in front of him either. So he might have still made it, right? Mm. But you think a guy like Robert De Niro was like, I'm not going to jail, you know?
Well, he said that.
Yeah. So, yeah. But it was so cool for it to go that way. I was satisfied at the end, which I didn't know I would be. If Al Pacino got shot, I think I would have been unhappy. This is how it should have ended. So, yeah.
Fair enough.
There you go.
Fair enough.
Heat.
All right. Heat at your number 7. My number 6. Is another Ridley Scott film from moving on from Gladiator. It's from Thelma and Louise back in 1991.
What?
Yeah.
Okay, everyone. I want to tell you a quick story about this before Paul tells you.
Go
his.
On.
Paul saw this with an ex-girlfriend of his from high school. Yeah, boy. I remember this.
Jeez, okay.
No, it's... Fuck it. It's Georgia, all right?
Yeah.
All right, so...
I remember watching My Own Private Idaho with her.
Yeah, but you saw that one with her too, right? But I remember that you... This is the first time we had this like sort of like film conversation in school, right? Me and Paul are like, yo... There's this thing, and we talked about the end where, of course, you're about to say they drove off a cliff.
Drove off a cliff, right? They choose to die rather than being taken to jail by the patriarchy.
There. Yeah. You said almost those exact words to me back then. You said, this is how this works. And that was George's interpretation. These women would rather die than live in a man's world, essentially.
Yep.
Right? That was the first time I was like, wow. I just, it was so weird that kind of shit, that political thing, I had never thought about it like that before.
No, well, it was the first time.
Yeah, but it was, exactly. But it was the first time I thought to myself, wow, women really don't have a good time a lot of the time in this industry, in the world, because of men. And I don't know, it was just my first pang of that, so that's why I just wanted to tell you, that is the thing I always remember about us.
I honestly don't remember that conversation, nor seeing it with her, so...
Yeah, well, I think you guys would have had a conversation about it because she was totally fucking femo.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
All good in that regard. But what I really appreciate about this, apart from the craft of, obviously it's the lead up to the scene and, you know, they embrace hands and they kiss and whatever else. And it's got your favorite Michael Madsen in this movie as well.
Oh, that fat fuck.
But it's from the side and the car drives off. There's nothing CG about this. This is a car driving off a cliff and it looks real, but... What really struck me about this and why it's at my number 6 is that this is framed as a positive. This is not a sad ending to this movie, even though they die.
You think it is?
Yeah. It fades. It freeze frames for a moment.
The music is uplifting.
It's uplifting. It freeze frames. It goes to white. It doesn't fade out to black. It fades out to white, which is a really interesting choice as well. This is their, unfortunately, the way things go, their best ending. And we're not meant to be sad for them. We're meant to be like, they fucking escaped. Good on them.
All right. I read this movie very differently when I saw it as a child in high school, to be fair. And then I went to my lit teacher and I said, hey, did you think this? And he said, that's exactly how I read the movie as well. Huh. This movie isn't, in my opinion, actually about the patriarchy or this and that. In my opinion, these two women were in love with each other.
Yeah.
And on every turn, a man got in the way. Brad Pitt got in the way. The Harvey Keitel got in the way. And they actually found that it's not so much that they're escaping the patriarchy. They just want to be together and the men in the world won't let them do it. So they fucking kill them. You know what I mean? They died together.
But again, but they choose to die together.
Yes.
So it's still a happy ending for them.
I got a problem.
I know. You're very... You don't like that kind of shit.
I understand. I understand.
Yeah,
I
mean, I'm only talking to you the way the film frames it. It could have been this dour, dark, you know,
and they just
adagio type of music and fade to black.
Yeah, yeah,
but it wasn't. It was uplifting, and it was the film just starts. The car just starts to dip as the film freezes and goes to white.
Look at the trail of
starts right,
and even Harvey
as
Keitel,
opposed to following it all the way down, explosion or whatever else it is, just watching the mangled wreck of a body.
Yeah. And then Harvey Keitel running in slow motion, that was cool too, because he was like, no.
I can't count that as part of this because it wasn't the final shot.
That's fine. It's all context.
Yep.
There you are. Excellent. Nice one. My number six, people, is Birdman. Birdman. Okay. Now, here's the thing. The reason everyone's, I'm sure, seen Birdman, but in case you haven't, Michael Keaton is a sort of a washed up kind of actor, and this is about his sort of final kind of swan song type performance in a New York theater kind of thing. And he is obviously weird. He's obviously got some kind of mental condition. At the beginning of the film, it looks like he's floating on air. That is clearly happening inside his head. And at the end of the film, he's in hospital because he's pulled a gun on himself on stage and everything, and he still survived or whatever. And he's in the hospital bed by himself. He's still seemingly suicidal. We're not quite sure what happens, but Emma Stone, his daughter, walks back into the room, and he's not on his bed. The window is open, and we're like, oh my God, he's jumped out and he's killed himself. She then runs out to the window, and instead of looking down, looks up and smiles. And now I'm thinking to myself, and this is the reason this is good for me, or I thought I like it, is that it's one of those, it pulls a rug out of from under you kind of endings. Because in the theater, I'm like, he's flying. Oh, he can fly. That's awesome. She saw him flying, and the happiness made me happy because that was cool. And then,
not the way I interpreted it.
I know. Later on, I'm like, no, here's what happened. I think you might have told me, or I read it somewhere. It's like, no, dude. She's his daughter. She's got the same illness he has. She hallucinates the same way he does. And instead of her saying, oh, he actually jumped out the window and died and is splattered on the street pizza on the floor, she chooses to believe that he's fucking like flying around. And that's why she's happy. And I'm like, oh, and that's probably what happened, Paul. I mean, I know everyone's like,
but that's fun. That's not the fun, the wrong word, but that's the interesting, intriguing part of
the ending. That's the gambit of it, right? Yeah. But the thing is, I walked out happy and got sad later. That's better than being sad straight away. So I say that was the bomb, in my opinion.
Wayne blew his load and then felt shame.
I know. Just like every other time.
All right, yeah, that's an interesting choice. I can totally see why it's on your list. My number five is a film I don't think you've seen, Wayne, and it's one which is very haunting, a little bit in a similar kind of way. It really leaves you like, ugh. Mm-hmm. It's called The Invitation from 2015. This is the most recent film on my list.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about The Invitation.
By a long, long way. Directed by Karen Kusama. Kusama? I think that's the way you say your name.
Sure.
And it effectively follows a couple who are invited to his ex-wife's house for a dinner party.
Right.
And there's a whole bunch of their friends that are there and some, because she disappeared. She had a mental breakdown after the death of their child.
Mm-hmm.
And she went off and joined this sort of commune cult, basically.
Okay.
So that's the sort of gambit / joke of
the film. I did read about this one. Yeah, keep going.
And her new partner, who's also from the cult, they're hosting this dinner party. And he starts to become convinced, but we're not sure whether it's his mental illness, whether mm-hmm. he's still grieving and about the death of their child, or whether he's really legitimately tapping into something here, that there's some menace to these people.
Mm-hmm.
They've invited them around for nefarious kind of reasons. And that's the way the film plays out. So it's this psychological thriller, which eventually sort of teeters over into horror as it turns out. Oh, absolutely. This cult, they're a death cult. They want to take as many people with them as they can.
They kill people.
Now is the time. The friend, the guy who's come with them, they all start killing all the other guests. Anyway, the film ends with...
And when they kill guests, what do they do, Paul? Is there a lantern situation?
Yes, that's right. So once they start their death killing people, they light a red lantern out the front of the house. This is to signify they've been cleansed or whatever it is. It's been successful. That happens here, even though three of the guests live. The couple live and another guy live as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Eden is his ex-wife's name, and she says, can I go outside? And you think it's just this sort of moment of like, oh, please help. No, she wants to be taken outside because she can see the number of red lanterns, because this is all in the Hollywood Hills.
And
the final shot is the surviving couple holding hands in the foreground, and the Hollywood Hills are splayed out in front of them.
Full of lanterns.
With about, 10, 12 lanterns just dotted across, and the police helicopter over the top and police sirens ratcheting up as they come closer and closer. It's chaos. This death cult has seeded throughout Hollywood Hills.
So there's way more people that are
maybe
doing it.
And you just don't think about that. It just feels like this is this very, very intimate one group, one setting, one group of people story. And then when it unveils that this is something they've been obviously planning as a cult and gone across as many of these rich residences as possible,
it's far reaching.
It has this huge kind of wham, gut punch of an ending.
That is actually a cool way to end a show like that. Like, just to, like, you know, like, you weren't expecting it.
No.
Yeah.
So, and there was almost no warning at all. Like, maybe you rewatch it again, you might see some clues here and there. I've only watched it once and it was really impactful. 2015's The Invitation is my number five.
Very nice. My number five, I picked this one not because there's any particular cleverness or spectacularness about the final shot, but it's actually more a celebration of an editor who knows what he's doing.
Mm.
The movie is Whiplash.
Oh, yeah.
Whiplash. Okay. And if you haven't seen it, anyone, it's about Miles Teller. He enrolls in this music conservatory to become a drummer. He's mentored by J.K. Rowling. His name's Terrence Fletcher, who has unconventional training methods to push him so far, and all of his musicians, beyond the boundaries of reason and sensibility. Their fingers are bleeding, all kinds of shit. It's a really intense film. Now, the end of the film has, it's a lot of machinations, but long story short, it involves Miles Teller going out on stage, playing for J.K. Rowling in his band. J.K. Rowling pulls some shit on him to try and fuck him up because he knows that he got him fired.
Mm-hmm.
But and then he gets him off there. Miles Teller comes back on stage after running off and says, fuck this, I'm going to start playing, while J.K. Rowling is talking to the audience, which is a very important audience that actually can seal your future fate kind of thing. Anyway, he just starts playing. He starts playing Caravan, and he counts in the fucking orchestra. They do a great performance. Goes about 5 minutes. And then there's a drum solo that goes for another 2-3 minutes. And what happens is J.K. Rowling, through it, is like yelling at him, what the fuck? And he's like, fuck you. And finally,
say J.K. Rowling.
J.K. Rowling? J.K. Simmons. And Harry Potter comes in. No. And what happens is through, after, like, because Miles Teller is kicking so much ass on the drums, J.K. Simmons kind of forgets that he's mad at him and goes, this is a really great performance. It starts walking in and starts actually, you know, giving him like cues and going, yeah, up, 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 down, 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 down. And it becomes this connection they both have where they're really doing this amazing performance. And the final scene is just a last drum stroke, and it, like, after this insanely like stressful but awesome drum solo, and then dan, 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 bam, cut to black. That's it. Because I was sitting there going, I don't know how this is going to end, but I don't want any more moments after the end of the song. I don't want an epilogue where these guys make up. I don't want any of those things. It just needs to end so I can go, fuck, that was amazing, and then walk out of the cinema. The idea here I'm reading is that you're not quite sure really how it ends, because some people think it's triumphant because he won in front of the big people and hopefully, but other
people, displayed his talent.
Yes, but other people read it as tragic because Miles Teller finally succeeds, but then
he's
he
going
gives
nowhere.
In, well, he gives in to the obsession and madness of being that kind of person, where he's like, yeah, I agree, you gotta fuck people up. So he's like, and he'll just be an unhappy music guy like J.K. Simmons, who is successful, but fucking causes so much pain.
Mm.
So that's why it's cool. Whiplash, in case you haven't seen it, and I know I just spoiled it, but you really got to see it.
It's a great film.
It's still fucking amazing.
All right. Very nice choice. My number four is a classic film from John Hughes. It's The Breakfast Club.
Yeah. I was wondering if you'd put this in.
I know. I mentioned it last week. So
No. It's not about that. The end, you're talking about the fist pump.
Yeah, fist pump, freeze, fade out to black.
It's cool.
With Simple Minds is Don't You Forget About Me, sort of playing at the right time.
Here's an example of the 80s were hokey. If you look at the 80s now, they're hokey. This scene is a little fucking hokey if you go that way. But in the context of the time and the movie itself, it was actually like kind of rousing.
Well, this whole movie is a coming of age story, totally. Right? And I don't know if you could put a better button on what takes place here than, you know, the outcast, the rebel.
No, Bender is the guy who has to be happy now.
Yep.
Because he made connections.
He's made a connection, particularly with Molly Ringwald's, you know, beautiful little princess character.
Yes.
And, you know, they've formed something. And it probably won't go anywhere. Like, there's no way these two will
end up. You don't. Anyone you fuck in high school. I mean, we've seen one. We have friends who got together in high school and are still married today. And have an amazing, like, family and shit. That's the only time it's ever happened on Earth, I'm pretty sure. I'm sorry. Okay? It just doesn't go like that.
But in this particular case, he's just celebrating being in the moment. Like, yeah, this was this day of detention. And, you know, in the lead up to this, we get Anthony Michael Hall's, what's his name in the film?
Yeah, little blonde dude, I know.
Brian.
His
essay saying, you know, you asked us to write who we are and what we've worked out.
Basket case. Yes.
With the principal reading this letter in this moment, and they're all going home in their various ways, and Bender's just walking across the oval, and then, yep, gives it the fist pump, bam, freeze, out. It's very memorable, and I think it's perfect for its time. I think it's perfect for what it's trying to encapsulate, that these kids are grown up today. They are moving on to the next phase of their lives in their own particular ways.
It's the 80s.
They're all 17 or I think maybe 18 at the oldest, but yeah. The Breakfast Club, and it's freeze frame on John Bender and Judd Nelson's finest moment, because his career was downhill from there.
I think we're forgetting about From the Hip Ball.
Yes, I am.
Yes, you are. Fair enough. Yes, cool. Nice one. Very popular choice, I'm sure. And oddly apt, because my number four is a 1985 film.
Ooh, same year.
It's Back to the Future, baby. Ooh. Back to the Fizz Future.
Where we're going, there are no roads.
Now, that's what it is. Now, everyone's seen Back to the Future, right? I mean, we make a lot of assumptions on this show, but if you haven't, just go see it, all right? At the end of the film, after everything that's happened, all the time travel and everything, Marty arrives back in, you know, the world in October 1985. Everything seems to be right with the world. Then Doc, Christopher Lloyd, shows up with the DeLorean. Now, I need to tell you about 1985, everyone. If you were too young to know in 1985 and how we thought back then, hot cars were very big in 1985. The Lamborghini Countach was like, "Woo, this is the best car ever," right? All that sort of shit.
No.
And DeLoreans, forget about it. When I was a kid, I didn't even know cars could have gullwing doors. We don't get DeLoreans down here in Australia, okay?
Wow, so they're remaking it.
Have you seen that thing? Yeah. It's fucking beautiful and still has the gullwing doors. Anyway. So this car was already this shit because it leaves smoke fucking fire trails and goes 88 miles an hour and skips time and it's fucking gullwing doors again. So this time, fucking at the end of this
reasons
film...
Reasons why the DeLorean is good. Goes 88 miles per hour. That's three. Number two, can go back in time. Back Number in one, time. Gullwing doors.
Gullwing doors, friend. I mean, you think I didn't watch the TV series Mask? All right, that shit. That's right, man. That shit turns into wings. Anyway, that's oddly what happens here pretty much. At the end of the scene, Marty brings his girlfriend inside with Doc. We got to go back to the future, Marty. We got to get your kids.
It's your kids.
Fuck your kids, right? And so he's like, where are we going? We don't need roads. And the car just fucking folds up and actually like levitates in the air.
Yeah.
Tires folds up and it blasts off like a spaceship. And holy shit, people.
To be continued,
which is ballsy, I thought. But, you know, what do? It's just a visual that's burned into the brains of anyone who was kind of my age at the time.
All right.
Because not only was the car sweet, it's now a fucking spaceship, bitch. Where to Big Bird? I was just all about it at the time. And then I got pissed off at the end of like number two.
So did my daughter. She was really, she's like, what? Is that it?
It's still the bomb. So, you know, there you are. So Back to the Future.
Well, from that one to another beloved franchise, Wayne, beloved. As I give you to you the latest and last film in this series ever made. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
What up? Of course, man.
From 1989.
Yeah.
This one is, the shot is, they've won. So Indy is with his father, he's with Sala, he's with...
Marcus Brody.
And Marcus has said, basically, Indy, Henry, Sala, follow me, I know the way.
That's actually a really good Marcus Brody.
And off he rides, fucking floundering.
Floundering.
And they look at each other. You know, we've just had the revelation that Indy is named after the dog, and Sala is still chuckling away about this. And Indy takes off after Marcus.
No, he goes.
Lost
in his own warehouse. That's the library.
His own warehouse. Yeah, and off he charges after him, and then the other two follow. So the low shot is with the sun setting in the background, with one big cloud center. The sun's coming out, out of into the horizon. Blood red, kind of beautiful sunset.
Beautiful sunset.
As
the four horsemen.
The four horsemen, yeah. Marcus is first. Indy catches up. And then the others are just slightly behind. The four of them now riding off together literally into the sunset. You said hokey. This might be the hokiest shot of all time.
No. There's something about this one that makes it different.
Perfect.
You know why? It's the fucking music, Paul. Because this is
John Williams score.
It moves into the credits. Bam, 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 bam.
Yep.
And you're like, fuck, that's good. Right? Because that's
so
what
good.
That shit is.
Literally. I had my top three rewatching them again. I had chills watching them all. Like, yeah. I don't know how many times I've seen The Last Crusade, but I still had chills again.
We used to say this. That's the best adventure film ever made.
Oh, good. It's so good. I'm very wary about the next Indiana Jones film coming out after so long.
All right. So here's what I think, just really quickly. Okay. Yes. All right. So King of the Crystal Skull, sure. All
what?
Right. Yeah. Oh, okay. I'm actually intrigued about this, Paul. So we've seen the indie poster. We know it's coming. All right.
As Smiley said, Indiana Jones 4 in the lighting. Very good. Yep.
They're going to acknowledge 4. Sorry, the what you think doesn't exist 4. Because you're never seeing Shia LaBeouf again, am I right? I mean, are we expecting that shit in here? No, right?
And if we were expecting him, I think his behavior has now ruled him out, so...
I mean, it's been a long while since he's put that paper bag on his head and the fucking...
No, because he's been off in fucking rehab and whatever else has he been doing. I think so, from what I've read.
All right. Yeah, no, I don't think you're ever going to see Mutt again. No. Well, what are they possibly going to do now? I mean, look, I'm down for bringing back Elsa Schneider. Who's your lady in this movie, okay? Mm-hmm. But even so, I'm just...
This would have to be set, what, in the 60s or 70s even, maybe?
70s! Well, can you imagine?
It's 34 years after Last Crusade, which was set around... You know, World War II time, so...
Shit. What could they possibly do?
I don't know.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, yeah, no, but yeah, absolutely. No, this is great. I love this shot, man. So, yeah, I'm down. Very good.
Thank you. All right, over to you for your three.
My number three is... I don't know if it's quirky or not. Like, I'm not talking about the ending of this film, which is stellar, but I'm talking about the last shot, which stayed with me. It's Inglourious Basterds. Okay?
Okay.
Now, what happens at the end of this is Colonel Hans Lander... is like, I surrender to you. Here's my gun. Here's my fucking knife. And pop, 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 pop. And Brad Pitt is there with BJ Novak. And they're like, okay, well, he's doing...
From the office, yeah.
Yeah, he's from the office. And it's like, okay, well, you know, we'll take you in kind of thing. And he's basically made a deal with the US government that he's going to turn all the fucking states, all their evidence, and he's going to get off free. They decide, Brad Pitt decides he's not happy with that. So he kills the guy's thing, like the Hans Lander's fucking friend or whatever. And goes, what are you doing? He goes, I'm going to get yelled at. I've been yelled at before. And he said, pulls out his knife and then starts to carve a swastika in Hans Lander's head. And it looks horrible because you can see skin flaps as he's cutting. With
right,
his
yeah.
And that's like, oh my God, that's the second last scene. Because then the last scene is the shot up and Brad Pitt and BJ Novak are looking down. And he's looking and he pulls away the knife and they're both smiling this really evilly sort of rictus. And they're like, he's like, I think this just might be my masterpiece.
Yep.
Boom, cut to black. I couldn't have written and directed by Quentin Tarantino. You know, I was like, fuck. That got me for some reason because it's like, you know what?
That's odd.
This is a satisfying ending.
Okay, yeah, sure it is.
Yeah, it's because it's memorable to me. I sit there and it's always on my head. I'm like, yeah, that was a good ending, man. Because like, it's hard for Brad Pitt to get like that. And look at that. But you're happy that Hans Lander gets all that shit. So now you're sadistic a bit by liking it.
One of these topics is just very hard to shit on the other person for.
I know, right? Because they're not fighting much. It's like, well, yeah, you might like it. You like it. Yeah, exactly. But that's why I wonder if anyone else feels that way about this show. Because I'm like,
oh, because it's not a bad ending for sure. I did not factor in my head. So interesting.
A lot won't.
I think my number two will have factored in your head. Whether it makes your list, I don't know.
Sure.
And I know we talk about this film all the time, but this is a different set of parameters.
I've got another one like that.
My number two is Inception.
Nice. Okay, good. Not on my list, and I did think about it, right? Now, tell me what you like about the top scene. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. So, in this film, which is basically about, you know, you can go into people's dreams and change the way they think about things and influence them. In this particular film, so Cobb has a totem which he uses to tell himself when he is dreaming and not dreaming, because that's the whole point. You just don't know. Otherwise, if you knew, you wouldn't believe the shit you're doing. And so his totem is this spinning top. If the top stops spinning and falls over, he's in reality. If it keeps spinning forever, he's not.
That's right.
In this film, he's won. He's
come back to America.
Done the job. He's come back to America. Michael Payne.
His kids.
Michael Caine picks him up from the airport, takes him back to the house where his kids are. He spins the top on the table, all beautifully backed by Hans Zimmer's incredible piece, Time, which I'll maintain is one of the top 10 film score moments in history.
Sure.
As far as I'm concerned. He then sees the kids, gets distracted, runs over to embrace them. And the camera, with Cobb in the background holding and hugging his kids, sort of pans down to the top on the table, which is still spinning. Does it maybe just start to wobble?
It starts to wobble, then they cut. And that's the best thing about this. Because you're sitting there going, well, that wobble could have been a wobble because it's losing momentum and it's about to fall. Or it could have just been a wobble.
And it doesn't matter because Cobb's found this reality.
The truth that he wants.
Which is what he needs and wants in his life. And so he is happy and satisfied there. He'll never look back. Whether he is in a dream, whether he's in reality, this is now his happiness.
Quick shout out to Christopher Nolan's supposed note to Michael Caine, which he testifies to. Any scene that you're in, Michael Caine, is reality.
Real. And he was in that airport, and he said to the kids,
he was in that scene.
Your father's here, and they come running up with the boy having the worst haircut in the history of the universe.
Oh yeah,
but yeah,
odd thing to remember, but there. No, so that's real. And I prefer to think that it's real as well.
Either way works. So works. My number two is Inception.
Very nice. My number two is oddly another one from the indie series, Paulie.
Oh.
But it's Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Ooh.
Let me tell you about this, okay? So Indiana Jones at the end of the film, you know what I'm saying? Like, he finally he brings the Ark back, and he brings it back to the officials of the museum, and he's there with Marion Ravenwood, and they're all talking shit, and he's like, and he's talking with Porkins. The guy is actually
Porkins, right?
And the fucking end of the thing. And he's like, okay, where
are his only two acting credits? Star Wars and Lost Ark?
He was, you know, in Batman 1989?
Yeah.
He was the fat detective.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, think about the future, that guy. That was Porkins as well. He's actually got this odd storied career in being iconic
big franchise films.
Yeah, but in bit parts, you know, so... Anyway, but then Porkins, you know, they're talking about where's the Ark now, and then Porkins says to Indy, we've got Top Man looking at it. And then Indy leans in, who? Top Man.
Yep.
Cut to, whatever, a little bit of an epilogue, and then you see them taking the actual, the Ark in a crate, and a dude wheeling it through this warehouse, and the camera pans out, and the warehouse is huge, and there's like thousands and thousands of these crates. And the idea here is, and I didn't understand it at the time because I was watching it with my dad, and I'm sitting there going, what happened now? And he goes, well, the Ark is going to go into this fucking warehouse and no one's going to ever see it again.
Yep.
And I'm like, but he won. And he goes, yeah, but that's what happens with bureaucracy. That's my dad. And he's like, no one really gives a shit about anything you do after a while.
Well, that's a metaphor for life, really.
Absolutely. It's where I learned things. But the look, just seeing that vast warehouse. And look, I know you hate number four, but they come back to this. They actually do reference it, right? That's a good thing to do, man, because it's like, oh, someone saw it. And even in Last Crusade, remember when he's down under in the catacombs with fucking Ilsa, and they're looking at like hieroglyphs, and she's like, "What's that one for?" He goes, "That's the Ark of the Covenant." Yeah. And she's like, "Are you sure?" He goes, "Pretty sure." Yeah. Walks away, "Oh, Indy, you're the coolest motherfucker ever, man! You fucking got it back," and you are just like, "Oh, pretty sure." Oh, you cool bitch. So yeah,
that's
what I love about it. So yeah, there you go. Raiders of the Lost Ark final scene, big fan.
Very nice. All right. Wrapping up here with my 10-3-2 and then revealing my number 1, number 10,
Bring
The
it.
Shining, 9, The Quiet Earth, 8, Evil Dead 2, 7, The Shawshank Redemption, 6, Thelma and Louise, 5, The Invitation, 4, The Breakfast Club, 3, Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, 2, Inception, and my number 1. Instantaneously, when we agreed upon this last week,
I bet you it was the same as
this
mine.
Popped into my head and I just went, there is no better final shot in history. There is nothing else that stands out in your mind. The music is perfect. Because it's establishing the craziness of the character.
It so is.
Yeah. It is Fight Club.
Fight Club, baby. Yeah. That's my number 1, too.
Good. I'm glad. We're completely the same wavelength.
Because I was sitting there going, oh, but it's so obvious. But you know what? It's the right one. It's the most right one.
Because it is. I just don't think there is an argument. Of course, there's always an argument. But for me, stood out so spectacularly.
Tell us the scene.
So the narrator has just shot himself in the face.
Yep.
To kill off Tyler Durden, and now Ed Norton is somehow seemingly able to talk and fine, and Marla.
He just shot out his cheek, Paul. He had a hole in his cheek. Whatever. I know.
To symbolically kill Tyler Durden, and now he's back in control of himself. You met me at a really weird time in my life, he says to her.
Yes, that's so cool.
Which they have already planted through Project Chaos, whatever their name is. Yep. I can't remember the name of the
group. Whatever it was,
To blow up all the credit card companies so that all credit history will be destroyed. No one will have to pay back their bills and create chaos.
You know, you can't do that now with bloody Amazon Web Services. But anyway.
Back then, though. That
back then.
Fairly or seemingly a viable
strategy.
Only
one server per place.
And so they're up on whatever skyscraper where they're watching this and the buildings start to explode around them.
No, check this out, though. The cool thing about it is it's just a shot, very blue because it's just nighttime, right, outside. Them facing over the city, him and her holding hands.
I'm getting to the very final shot.
Oh, right.
They're already holding hands.
Yeah.
And then the buildings have already started to explode, but we see the last three other skyscrapers explode.
That was
And they
majestic.
Glance at each other and then look back out there, and then it cuts away and we're finished in the film.
Dude, that is the... First of all, seeing the boom, 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 and they're actually just falling down was so spectacular.
And again, all with the Pixies, Where is my mind?
Ding, 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 ding. And which I didn't know anything about the Pixies, but you're right. I knew the music was perfect because it was like, that's dirgy. Remember, this is like 90 whatever. So the
99.
Grunge, 99. Oh, yeah. So the grunge was still around, sort of. That was the best thing about it, I think. That was the way it actually came across. Because you don't just see buildings pancake one after another, but you're seeing it in the context of this almost sweet holding hands thing.
Yep.
Very cool.
With a guy who's got a gun wound in his
face. I know, it's so
weird.
But
it's all from behind, it's silhouetted.
That's why the movie's good, man. Even Tyler Durden's this shit, man. Like, just playing, anyway. Great movie.
It is a great film. Glad you agree. Wayne, give us your 10-3-1 then, just a reminder to the audience and particularly Troy.
Coolio. Number 10, The Big Night. Number 9, Good Will Hunting. 8 was Gladiator. 7, Heat. 6, Birdman. 5, Whiplash. 4, Back to the Future. 3 Inglourious Basterds, 2 Raiders of the Lost Ark, and number 1 was Fight Club.
All right. Any honorable mentions? My only one that I really emphasized and was reluctant to shop off was Heat.
Cool. I had The Graduate. At the end, very cool.
I've never seen that whole film, but I've read so much about it that I just can't be bothered watching it now.
I know. It is actually worth watching because... actually, I like old women and you don't, so... Yeah, maybe. But that whole cool thing is there. Toy Story 3, remember the very end of it? Where he's like, so long, partner, because Andy finally drives off.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, now I'm with a new family and this is me and my toys and we won't forget you. That has always killed me. I had The Breakfast Club as well. And I actually had The Dark Knight Rises. Which is the very final. The very final scene is when Joseph Gordon-Levitt goes into like what seems to be the Batcave, and then this thing comes up under him, the panel, and then it just fades to black after that. I'm like, cool. It's just, and you know, because Robin has never actually turned into Batman in the comics, and he never really was Robin. He is, just name is Robin. But you know,
yep,
yeah. Anyway, there you go.
All right, there we are. That's Alice. What about yours? We wrap up every episode of the show in a segment where you give us the feedback on the topic at hand. It's called the Pop 10.
Talk about. Talk about Pop 10.
Kicking off this week's Pop 10 with an explanation. So we were like, geez, no one got into this topic this week. What happened? Well, we normally get, I don't know, 40 or 50 responses. Yeah. We had like 9 or maybe even 20 or 30, but sometimes 20, 30, but often 40 or 50 responses. Yeah, yeah. This week we got like 10.
And I was like, hey, Paul, I can't find the fucking post. Like, I'm looking
at it. And it took until a post, literally as we hit record today, for Smiley, friend of the show, to say, hey, where's your post? I saw it somewhere, but I can't find it now to add my 2 cents. Turns out I added it to my own private Facebook wall and not into the group as I've done 374 times before today. Mm-hmm. So I apologize to everyone who's like, well, I didn't get a chance to weigh in on this topic. Only friends of mine.
who listen to the show
who have, or people who have become friends over time through back and forth exchanges.
Yeah, so sorry about that.
I do really, really apologize for that. Totally on me. Nothing to do with Paul Wayne over there. John, who's landed in, said, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Best use of a freeze frame outside the police squad shows.
That actually is the perfect freeze frame because you can see Paul Newman's face and Robert. It's just perfect. It is really cool.
The Godfather, I'm too. Such a beautiful shot through the door as it closes on Kate. I wanted to put this in there, and I have to be really honest here. It's such a quick final shot. The final scene, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Like, it's emphasizing that now Michael has fully embraced his hands being kissed by his lieutenants and whatever else. Just after he's denied to her that this is what's happening, and she's gone out to make them a drink, and she's looking back in, and they walk over to close the door. And the very final shot is just very quickly, and it's like a 3-second shot, if that, of the door closing over her. I'm like, it wasn't, the shot itself wasn't impactful enough. The scene, absolutely.
You want to hear something embarrassing? When Seinfeld parodied that with the Godfather episode,
I don't even remember
they actually at the end of the episode just closes like that, where the door closes between them, and that's the one I remember more than this one because I'm a fucking asshole. All right.
And number one from John, Evil Dead 2. When you realize who is in that drawing in the Necronomicon, David Powell, top level patron of the show and moderator of the Facebook listening committee, said this one doesn't need much consideration for him. Number 3, Casablanca, the beginning of a beautiful friendship, Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
Number 2, Breakfast Club. And number 1, Butch and Sundance. Greatest freeze frame in history again.
Cool.
Jonathan Kidd said, Thelma and Louise. What a wild, fun time. The Godfather. Nothing makes me feel more hopeless for everyone. And number 1, Empire Strikes Back. Even in terrible moments, there is hope. I guess, is that them standing looking out on the Millennium Falcon taking off?
Yes.
Is that the final shot?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yep. Sam Haley from the Movie Reviews and Tweaky Cues podcast. Significant to mention Sam now because next week on the show, Ken Review episode 376. Sam and sometimes co-host Machu will be coming on to do, strap yourselves in, ladies and gentlemen, the top 10 arousing scenes, show v show. Sam and Machu versus Wayne and myself. That might not be a good one to introduce your children / friends
to. You know what's going to be weird as well is that you and I have to agree on what makes a dick hard. It's going to be weird, bro. It's going to be weird.
It's going to be very weird. The weirdest show ever for episode 376. 4, seemingly, I think, straight guys talking about what makes them hard.
And I know for a fact that Paul and I don't swing exactly the same way. So, like, this will be weird, everyone.
Yeah, look out for the Patreon recording of Wayne and I trying to agree on that list. That could be an absolute shenanigans. Anyway, Sam said number 3, Fight Club, so he's right there with us. Number 2, Casablanca. Number 1, The Graduate, as per your honourable mention. The way it just lingers and creates this sudden unease, shitting all over the supposedly happy ending. Brilliant.
Very cool.
Your cousin, Ashbra, said, fuck, this is going to be a tough one. Cracks knuckles. Challenge accepted. Time for some research. Image of Pornhub.
Top 10 money shots.
Yeah, there you go. Joe Morris from the Two Peas on a podcast, which is making a comeback.
Oh.
Not that we're announcing here for the first time, but just to you listeners who may listen to Gerald back in the past. He's coming back. His show is returning. The Beach House finally can put it on a list, Paul Prezzola. No, Gerald, no, I can't, because even the last shot of that film does not earn its ridiculous runtime nor boringness before it. B Dizzle, Billy Dunham from the We Watch the Thing podcast, says this is tough, actually, because there's a lot of great ones. Number three, Planet of the Apes from 68.
Yeah.
It feels like a gimmick now, but man, at the time, that shot of the Statue of Liberty was so shocking and grand. Number two, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Mm-hmm.
Joel and Clem running down the snowy beach together on a loop is so beautiful to me. Like, no matter how many times these two try and run away and force themselves to forget each other, they still find their way back.
And then break up again. Yep. It's a weird movie.
And number one, The Graduate. Sam Hurley nailed it. That lingo, good God, it says a lot. And then the last two here, Maureen Lane. So thank you, Maureen, for your contribution.
Yes.
Casablanca, perfect ending, number one, perfect movie. Number two, Some Like It Hot, Nobody's Perfect. Jack Lemmon and Joe E. Brown dialogue was way ahead of its time.
Mm.
Number three, The Pit and the Pendulum. Vincent Price, a big part of my childhood. And the final close-up of those eyes has haunted me ever since.
Haven't seen it, but okay, cool.
And then, of course, the people who made this episode possible, the Lawlers, Kevin and Trisha, here is what they said. Number 10. The Cabin in the Woods.
I thought about that.
Big Fist.
Yeah.
Number 9, Full Metal Jacket. M-I-C-K-E-Y-M or U-S-E.
I got it.
I got it now. Number 8, Inception.
Of course.
Number 7, Final Destination 2. The very final shot is the kids blown up, tending to the barbecue, the gas barbecue, and his arm lands in front of the mum.
It
pans down to show the arm. She's screaming and losing her shit, so it's not all over. Number 6, Usual Suspects, off for reasons that we described. Mm-hmm. Number 5, The Deviled Rejects, Freebird playing. 4, The Shawshank Redemption. 3, Wayne, Raiders Lost Ark.
Boom.
Number 2, Midsommar, Danny Smile. You haven't seen that movie, have you?
No.
Mm-hmm. And number 1, it's going to be a vote for you, Wayne, from The Lawlers, Back to the Future.
Yay!
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Man, I thought I was so clever with that Back to the Future pick. Oh, well.
You didn't see their feedback, so yeah, you were. Okay. So they only mentioned that. That is it for the topic today, the top 10 final shots in film. Thanks again to the Lawlers. And you've already heard what's happening next week, episode 376. Wayne, how do the good folk get in touch with us with their feedback on the topics at hand or indeed more generally?
Once you bounce from the Countdown Podcast... Sorry, what's it, the podcast?
The countdownpodcast.com
page, because it's not ready yet. You could Google the Countdown movie and TV reviews and find our socials, or send us an email at thecountdownpodcast@gmail.com.
On the webpage, it is, all the socials are there. You can just click there too. So,
oh, okay, do that too.
I've only said about 43 times before Wayne will remember it. Otherwise, follow us on Podbean where we host the show. Don't forget the Facebook community. We've had enough shout-outs to it today. And that's really it from us today. Thank you so much for joining us for episode 375 of The Countdown. My name is Paul.
My name is Wayne.
And this has been The Soundboard.
They've done studies, you know. 60% of the time, it works.
This is shit.
He's talking about final shots there. 60% of the time, it works.
He's not talking about shit.
Every
you.
Time. Catch you next time. See ya.